Europe and the Faith by Hilaire Belloc. Chapter 9. The Defection of Britain. One thing stands out in the fate of modern Europe: the profound cleavage due to the Reformation. One thing made that wound. It was almost mortal, so deep and lasting: the failure of one ancient province of civilization, and one only, to keep the faith. This province whereof I write, Britain. The capital event, the critical moment, in the great struggle of the faith against the Reformation, was the defection of Britain. It is a point which the modern historian, who is still normally anti-Catholic, does not and cannot make. Yet the defection of Britain from the faith of Europe 300 years ago is certainly the most important historical event in the last 1,000 years, between the saving of Europe from the barbarians and these our own times. It is perhaps the most important historical event since the triumph of the Catholic Church under Constantine. Let me recapitulate the factors of the problem, as they would be seen by an impartial observer, from some great distance in time, or in space, or in mental attitude. Let me put them as they would appear to one quite indifferent to, and remote from, the antagonists. To such an observer, the history of Europe would be that of the great Roman Empire passing through the transformation I have described, its mind first more and more restless, then more and more tending to a certain conclusion, and that conclusion the Catholic Church. To summarize what has gone before, the Catholic Church becomes, by the 5th century, the soul, the vital principle, the continuity of Europe. It next suffers grievously from the accident, largely geographical, of the Eastern Schism. It is, of its nature, perpetually subject to assault, from within, because it deals with matters not open to positive proof, from without, because all those, whether aliens or guests or parasites, who are not of its civilization, are naturally its enemies. The Roman Empire of the West, in which the purity and the unity of this soul were preserved from generation to generation, declined in its body during the Dark Ages, say, up to and rather beyond the year 1000. It became coarsened and less in its material powers. It lost its central organization, the imperial court, which was replaced first by provincial military leaders, or kings, then, later, by a mass of local lordships jumbled into more or less national groups. In building, in writing, in cooking, in clothing, in drawing, in sculpture, the Roman Empire of the West, which is ourselves, forgot all but the fundamentals of its arts, but it expanded so far as its area is concerned. A whole belt of barbaric Germany received the Roman influence, baptism, and the Mass. With the Creed there came to these outer parts reading and writing, building in brick and stone, all the material essentials of our civilization, and, what is characteristic of that culture, the power of thinking more clearly. It is centuries before this slow digestion of the barbarian reached longitude 10 degrees east, and the Scandinavian peninsula. But 1,000 years after our Lord, it has reached even these, and there remains between the unbroken tradition of our civilization in the West and the schismatic but Christian civilization of the Greek Church nothing but a belt of paganism from the corner of the Baltic southward, which belt is lessened year by year by the armed efforts and the rational dominance of Latin culture. Our Christian and Roman culture proceeds continuously eastward, mastering the uncouth. After this general picture of a civilization dominating and mastering in its material decline a vastly greater area than it had known in the height of its material excellence, this sort of expansion in the dark. The impartial observer, whom we have supposed, would remark a sort of dawn. That dawn came with the 11th century, 1000 to 1100 A.D. The Norman race, the sudden invigoration of the papacy, the new victories in Spain, at last the First Crusade, mark a turn in the tide of material decline, and that tide works very rapidly towards a new and intense civilization, which we call that of the Middle Ages. That high renewal which gives Europe a second and most marvelous life, which is a late reflowering of Rome, but of Rome revivified with the virtue and the humor of the faith. The second thing that the observer would note in so general a picture would be the peculiar exception formed within it by the group of large islands lying to the north and west of the continent. Of these, the larger, Britain, had been a true Roman province. But very early in the process, in the middle and end of the 5th century, it had, on the first assault of the barbarians, been cut off for more than the lifetime of a man. Its gate had been held by the barbarian. Then it was re-Christianized almost as thoroughly as though even its eastern part had never lost the authority of civilization. The mission of St. Augustine recaptured Britain. But Britain is remarkable in the history of civilization for the fact that, alone of civilized lands, it needed to be recaptured at all. The western island of the two, the smaller island, Ireland, presented another exception. It was not compelled to the Christian culture, as were the German barbarians of the continents, by arms. No Charlemagne with his Gallic armies forced it tardily to accept baptism. It was not savage like the Germanies. It was therefore under no necessity to go to school. It was not a morass of shifting tribes. It was a nation. But in a most exceptional fashion, though already possessed, and perhaps because so possessed, of a high pagan culture of its own, it accepted within the lifetime of a man, and by spiritual influences alone, the whole spirit of the creed. It's the civilization of the Roman West was accepted by Ireland, not as a command, nor as an influence, but as a discovery. Now, let this peculiar fate of the two islands to the north and west of the continent remain in the observer's mind, and he will note when the shock of what is called the Reformation comes, new phenomena attaching to those islands, cognate to their early history. Those phenomena are the thesis which I have to present in the pages that follow. What we call the Reformation was essentially the reaction of the barbaric, the ill-tutored, and the isolated places external to the old and deep-rooted Roman civilization against the influences of that civilization. The Reformation was not racial. Even if there were such a physical thing as the Teutonic race, and there is nothing of the kind, the Reformation shows no coincidence with that race. The Reformation is simply the turning back of that tide of Roman culture, which for 500 years had set steadily forward and had progressively dominated the insufficient by the sufficient, the slower by the quicker, the confused by the clear-headed. It was a sort of protest by the conquered against a moral and intellectual superiority which offended them. The Slavs of Bohemia joined in that sincere protest of the lately and insufficiently civilized, quite as strongly as, and even earlier than, the vague peoples of the sandy heaths along the Baltic. The Scandinavian, physically quite different from these tribes of the Baltic Plain, comes into the game. Wretched villages in the Mark of Brandenburg, as Slavonic in type as the villages of Bohemia, revolt as naturally against exalted and difficult mystery as do the isolated villages of the Swedish valleys or the isolated rustics of the Cevennes or the Alps. The revolt is confused, instinctive, and therefore enjoying the sincere motive which accompanies such risings, but deprived of unity and of organizing power. There has never been a fixed Protestant creed. The common factor has been, and is, reaction against the traditions of Europe. Now, the point to seize is this. Inimical as such a revolt was to souls, or, to speak upon the mere historical plane, to civilization, bad as it was that the tide of culture should have begun to ebb from the far regions which it had once so beneficently flooded, the Reformation, that is, the reaction against the unity, the discipline, and the clear thought of Europe, would never have counted largely in human affairs, had it been confined to the external fringe of the civilized world. That fringe would probably have been reconquered. The inherent force attaching to reality, and to the stronger mind, should have led to its recovery. The northern Germanies were, as a fact, reconquered when Richelieu stepped in and saved them from their southern superiors. But perhaps it would not have been reconquered. Perhaps it would have lapsed quite soon into its original paganism. At any rate, European culture would have continued undivided and strong without these outer regions. Unfortunately, a far worse thing happened. Europe was rent and has remained divided. The disaster was accomplished through forces I will now describe. Though the revolt was external to the foundations of Europe, to the ancient provinces of the empire, yet an external consequence of that revolt arose within the ancient provinces. It may be briefly told. The wealthy took advantage, within the heart of civilization itself, of this external revolt against order. For it is always to the advantage of the wealthy to deny general conceptions of right and wrong, to question a popular philosophy, and to weaken the drastic and immediate power of the human will, organized throughout the whole community. It is always in the nature of great wealth to be insanely tempted, though it should know from actual active experience how little wealth can give, to push on to more and more domination over the bodies of men, and it can do so best by attacking fixed social restraints. The landed squires, then, and the great merchants, powerfully supported by the financial communities in the principal towns, felt that, with the Reformation, their opportunity had come. The largest fortune-holders, the nobles, the merchants of the ports and local capitals even in Gaul, that nucleus and stronghold of ordered human life, licked their lips. Everywhere in northern Italy, in southern Germany, upon the Rhine, wherever wealth had congested in a few hands, the chance of breaking with the old morals was a powerful appeal to the wealthy, and therefore throughout Europe, even in its most ancient seats of civilization, the outer barbarian had allies. These rich men, whose avarice betrayed Europe from within, had no excuse. Theirs was not any dumb instinctive revolt like that of the outer Germanies, the outer Slavs, nor the neglected mountain valleys, against order and against clear thought, with all the hard consequences that clear thought brings. They were in no way subject to enthusiasm for the vaguer emotions roused by the gospel, or for the more turgid excitements derivable from Scripture and an uncorrected orgy of prophecy. They were on the make. The rich in Montpellier and Nîmes, a knot of them in Rome itself, many in Milan, in Lyon, in Paris, enlisted intellectual aid for the revolt, flattered the atheism of the Renaissance, supported the strong, inflamed critics of clerical misliving, and even winked solemnly at the lunatic inspirations of obscure men and women filled with visions. They did all these things as though their object was religious change, but their true object was money. One group, and one alone, of the European nations was too recently filled with combat against vile non-Christian things to accept any parley with this anti-Christian turmoil. That unit was the Iberian Peninsula. It is worthy to remark, especially on the part of those who realize that the sword fits the hand of the Church, and that Catholicism is never more alive than when it is in arms. I say it is worthy of remark by these that Spain and Portugal, through the very greatness of an experience still recent when the Reformation broke, lost the chance of combat. There came indeed from Spain, but from the Basque nation there, that weapon of steel, the Society of Jesus, which St. Ignatius formed, and which, surgical and military, saved the faith, and therefore Europe. But the Iberian Peninsula, rejecting as one whole, and with contempt, and with abhorrence, and rejecting rightly, its any consideration of revolt, even among rich men, thereby lost its opportunity for combat. It did not enjoy the religious wars which revivified France, and it may be urged that Spain would be the stronger today had it fallen to her task, as it did to the general populace of Gaul, to come to hand grips with the Reformation at home, to test it, to know it, to dominate it, to bend the muscles upon it, and to re-emerge triumphant from the struggle. I say, then, that there was present in the field against the Church a powerful ally for the reformers, and that ally was the body of immoral rich who hoped to profit by a general break in the popular organization of society. The atheism and the wealth, the luxury and the sensuality, the scholarship and the aloofness of the Renaissance answered, over the heads of the Catholic populace, the call of barbarism. The iconoclasts of greed joined hands with the iconoclasts of blindness and rage, and with the iconoclasts of academic pride. Nevertheless, even with such allies, barbarism would have failed. The Reformation would today be but a historical episode without fruit. Europe would still be Christendom. Had not there been added the decisive factor of all, which was the separation of Britain. End of Part 1 of Chapter 9.